Programs prior to that, The one notable exception by it, which is quite significant, was the Motor Industry Development Program. But for the most part, South African government focus was on macro strategies with less emphasis given to the micro. The failure or limited success of macro strategies to strengthen the rand, to attract investment, to reduce unemployment, usually a shift in focus of South African government from the mid to late 2000s towards the micro foundations of growth. Important over here in terms of the turning point as GISA, and after as GISA, then you have the industrial policy framework in the IPAS. Recently, you have the DTI's 12I and MSEP, very important programs. Why this is important is that we increase our resource dedication to industrial policy strongly from 2007-2008 onwards. However, at the same time, the global economy and the South African economy is not slowing down from 2007-2008 onwards. And that's important to refer to in evaluating industrial policy. So how we approach our studies, so costing of South African industrial development methodology, firstly, we aggregate data, both expenditures and as well as cash expenditure data for these different industrial development programs and initiatives from 94 up until the most recent data we can get, which is 2014-15 fiscal year. And it's important to note here we use financial costs and not economic costs. So financial cost is essentially the amount that a department spends on a particular policy or program or incentives. Whereas if we talk about the economic costs, we would have to include sort of the economic cost of capital and the potential returns that would accrue to the economy for a particular investment at that point in time, or actually to today. So we're not doing that, we're just looking at financial costs. Obviously, with industrial development, the key focus of the Department of Trade and Industry would have primarily acted from the trade, from the Department of Trade and Industry, and we also looked to a limited extent the Ministry of Small Business.
Sorry, Chair, I know I'm the youngest of the Appropriation Committee, and for me, this gentleman is going too fast, and I want to go and look for everything that has happened. He's going a little bit too fast for me.
Should I back up a bit? Just continue with a slow pace.
Just a slow pace.
Okay.
So we can capture everything.
Okay. I'm very passionate about subject, so but I'll I'm having Lucas aid, but I'll try and slow down. Thank you, hello member. So obviously from here, so regarding our methodology, we looked at costs, and it was primarily financial costs from different government departments, primarily the DTI, and then to an extent the Economic Development Department, which was established in 2009, and then subsequently the Small Business Department, the Ministry of Small Business, was established in 2014. We decided the establishment of these particular ministries, we had some functions from the DTI moving to Department of Economic Development and Ministry of Small Business, and still updated some of the costs incurred by those departments. Our classification, I think, is important to note, and we're quite transparent about this, it's imprecise. So when we say that SEZ, so special economic zones, allocated X over the 20-year period we're looking at, some money that goes to some resources dedicated to special economic zones actually for manufacturing, but it's difficult to actually have a precise definition. So we approximate in terms of our definitions, and then we use something known as the SIC codes, that Standard Industry Classification, it's an international code. So we use that. Data presented, as mentioned, first we look at time and at the nominal rands. So nominal rands is the amount that the Department of Trade Industry used on the auto sector 1996 in that particular year. And then we convert those figures to constant 2015-16 rands. So if that particular expense were to take place today, what would it cost us? And that's used on a fiscal year GDP multiplier. Very simple approach, and it gives you a better sense of how much actually costs. Because 2 million rands 10 years ago is very different than 2 million rands today. What we then do is we compare costs to the sector performance. And specifically we're interested in the most value add, so the growth of the sector, its exports, and employment, primarily, and on occasion do they get investment. Again, I've mentioned that outcome and benefits are very challenging to observe and calculate. This is partially because of data. So most of our data is from National Treasury, so we've got data from a few divisions within Treasury. Data is not complete, I think it's important to emphasize this here. Treasury only really started publishing tax expenditure data over the past 5 or 6 years, which can be made oversight perspective is a bit concerning because we don't know exactly how much is dedicated to a particular sector. That's very important for the legislature. We use Census and Quantech data to give us industry level data. South Africa has a little bit of challenge in the sense that we don't have a reliable firm level data. I know right now there are some initiatives by National Treasury to establish firm level data. Why firm level data is important is because it allows you to actually establish a control group. So if we have, say, 10 particular firms in the petroleum textile sector, and we have 5 of them that are receiving the incentive and 5 not receiving the incentive, and we can track their performance over time, and if we say, like, hey, the 5 that are receiving the incentive are performing a lot better than those that aren't receiving the incentive, controlling for our factors, we can then try and infer causality to say that, hey, the incentive is actually working. But right now, we don't have that data as a country. I think it's also important to note for the Appropriations Committee as well as the legislature more generally that a lot of programs don't have clear and explicit targets. This has changed in reporting and has improved over the past couple of years when you look at budget votes per department. But by and large, performance reporting and monitoring data is rather poor. Colleague Nelia has a lot more experience in this and could discuss the data if you could note some of these things. Even when more recently the DPM meets, when the presidency tried to evaluate the outcomes of a few large policy incentives, it's not in their study as well. But a lot of our attempts to look at the outcomes of policies and programs is measured by the quality of our data. And I've mentioned previously that outcomes and benefits are challenging to observe and calculate. I think there's some bit of humility we end the study with. So having described our approach, let's look at general manufacturing. Let's look at overall resources dedicated to the sector or to the economy. So between 1994 and 1995, that's the first fiscal year of democracy, 2014-15, which is the most recent data we have. We have a total of 84.3 billion rand from an expenditure side dedicated to industrial development initiatives. These sectors account for more than half the spending. It's important to know that, and that's motor vehicles and components, general manufacturing, and clothing and textiles. If the 84.3 billion, results in an average share of main budget dedicated to industrial development of 0.5% between 1995 and 2004-2005, so the first 10 years of democracy, around 0.5% of annual budget was dedicated on the expenditure side to industrial development. This increases considerably since 2005-2006, and I've mentioned the National Industrial Policy Framework plays a significant role over here. What this then indicates, based on the numbers, is Africa is taking industrial policy a lot more seriously, and that's by allocating more resources to it on the expenditure and the expenditure side. Again, it's important to note that resources dedicated for small business development increases quite strongly from 2007. I think that's important given that our country doesn't have a very significant and a large SME sector. And if we expect the 4.3 billion in 2015-16 rand, the amount it amounts to 122 billion rands of expenditure dedicated to industrial development initiatives in that 20-year period. Overall resources, and here we look at tax expenditure. The tax expenditure is revenue that we've forgone as a country for the purpose of promoting industrial development.
So if I can remind you, not to be fast again, not so that you can catch up, this is serious business. We need to learn from you and also...
I'll go back and emphasize this because I think these are the crux of our findings. So over the 20-year period, we've dedicated 84.3 billion rands in nominal rands to industrial development initiatives, and that's on the expenditure side. That's what come off national government's budgets. I think it's important to note over here that in the first 10 years of democracy, on average, we were contributing 0.5% of our annual budget to industrial development initiatives, and that increases considerably to about 0.9% from 2005 onwards, so the second decade of democracy. Why this particular point is quite important is because it indicates the African government is dedicating more resources to industrial development, taking industrial policy a lot more seriously. Moving on to the tax expenditure side, the tax expenditure side is essentially the resources the state has under the revenue, the potential revenue the state has all gone. So, going on for the purpose of promoting industrial development or industrial policy. Essentially how this works is the African government may give tax rates to a few different sectors, and those tax rates, had they not been allowed, would have resulted in higher revenue for the country. Obviously, I think it's important to note that this doesn't represent the actual amount that the state would have received, because perhaps in the absence of those tax incentives, economic activity would have been less. But this is very important. If you compare these figures, so this is 207.3 billion in terms of tax expenditure. On the previous slide, we said 84.3 billion in terms of actual expenditure. So the amount that we're, amount of resources we're dedicating to industrial policy, is far more on the perspective of the instrument of tax incentives rather than on budget expenditure. Again, this is quite important from the perspective of public finance and the allocation of resources. Again, on the tax expenditure side, we note that one particular sector accounts for 3/4 of total tax expenditure. Now, that is quite significant. We contrast this previous slide where we see a lot more different sectors benefiting from actual expenditure that's on the budget. Over here, it's just largely 1, 2, 3, 4 sectors. With the motor vehicles and component sector getting the overwhelming majority of tax expenditure dedicated over the 20-year period. General manufacturing has got a significant component as well. This increases, which is more pronounced over the past 5 or 6 years following the National Industrial Policy Framework, as well as BCI's Club I tax incentive. Again, like I've noted in the previous slide, that support for the small business sector has also increased. So National Treasury have a suite of tax incentives for small business development. Having looked at the take-up, it's not been particularly strong when it comes to the few tax incentives allocated directly for small business. If we were to express this figure over here, at 207.3 billion rands, which is nominal rands, in today's rands, that's in 2015-16 financial year rands, South Africa incurred a significant 393 billion rand tax expenditure over that 20-year period to support industrial development initiatives. When we combine both of these pie charts, that's 84.3 and 207.3, we get a sense of the total resources dedicated both on the expenditure side as well as the tax expenditure side for industrial development initiatives in that 20-year period. And that amounts to 291.73 billion rands. That's normal rands. And if that normal figure is expressed in current rands, 2015-16 rands, it's a significant 476.7 billion rands. So that just gives you a sense of the quantum of resources that we've dedicated to industrial policy initiatives.
Maybe you should extend
the percentage. Okay. Sure. So if we, hypothetically, we said we dedicated a million rand to the PBO's expenditure in 1996. What you can do with a million rand in 1996 is quite different to what you can do with a million rand in 2006, so 20 years later. Right? And that's primarily because of inflation. So the value of money, what you can do with money, actually erodes over time. So by splitting a figure in nominal figures, or nominal rands, you get an actual rand amount that was on the budget of the National Treasury or the department's votes, right? What we do, we take that figure of 96, and then we use something as a GDP multiplier, which is essentially a multiplier that you convert that figure from rands in 1996 to 2006. So a million rand in 1996 may be 3 million rands today or something of the sort. So why this is useful is because if we say, okay, we dedicated 10 billion rands, nominal rands, for support of the clothing sector, it doesn't give us a sense of how much it is today's rands because it's a nominal rands. So having a figure in current prices gives a better illustration of the dedication of resources you're putting into a particular policy or particular program. Okay?
Is that not giving us a false sense of what you actually spent? We understand you're converting it using a different formula, which it's an economical formula, obviously. But by converting it, I mean, you're actually then spent. is 273 or that sort of thing. So you can deal with it later, but I'm just a bit concerned about that figure that's used, and especially the fact that it's been faster as well.
Okay, so on that, we provide both nominal figures as well as the real figures. So both figures are provided in the presentation as well as in the summary as well as in the full report.
Just a quick study edition. I mean, the reason why we would want to talk about real rand is not to make it seem as if more money was spent in real in actual terms than was. But it's difficult to compare spending over years. So as the shadow said, we spent a million rand in 1996. The buy in 1996 was much greater than what you can buy with a million rand today. So what we're doing is we're saying, what were we actually buying? So we basically use 1 year as money and say, you know, in 1996, we could have bought, if it was a million rand, we could only bought 300,000 rand worth of goods. So basically making it comparable over years. And in economics, we often do that because you can't actually compare numbers over years if you don't take into account inflation. So it's basically just to make it comparable. I mean, I think from the finance perspective, we can say, you know, we've spent 200 billion on automobile incentives over the past few years, but then we want to actually see, did we get the benefits? We want to compare benefits over time of different programs, then we want to say, you know, the money we spent on MIGP versus the money we spent on the later programs, we have to look at buying power of the money at the time. So I think that gives us a better sense of how effective programs are by comparing them across years and not just yet. When Rashad and I spoke about this, we did think that it will be confusing. And so if you are at any point confused in that, please just come back us and ask us questions. Thank you.
Simple things, in 2006, we spent 2 million rand on small business. But in 1996, we spent 1 million rand. The reality is, in 2006, although in nominal rands we spent more, in real rands we actually spent less. So our support for the sector in rand terms actually reduced, even though on paper it may look like more support. And I think that's the only way you can really compare.
Thank you for the explanation.
Okay. So last point of thank you. The last point. Thank you. The last point I was making was that in real rands, that's 2015-16 rands. So if that expenditure would take place today, over the past 20-year period, we've contributed 477 billion rands to industrial support, industrial development initiatives. It's important to note over here that industrial development initiatives only on the expenditure side, that's expenditure on the budget, only represents about 29% of total resources dedicated to industrial development. The overwhelming majority is actually tax expenditure. The tax expenditure is 71% of total resources we've contributed to industrial development over time. This is significant, and as I've mentioned earlier on, because there's less emphasis placed on tax expenditure in terms of oversight compared to on-budget expenditure. So a lot of the discourse and debates on the MTBPS or the budget priorities are actually on the budget, but not what's off the budget actually costs us a lot more. And I think this requires a lot of attention.
When you speak of tax expenditure, we were talking about incentives.
Well, so tax expenditure more broadly, but I'm looking at incentives particularly.
Well, the reason why I ask is if it's a tax incentive, it's money you never had, so you wouldn't have spent it.
But you could have received it.
You could have received it, perhaps. But you could have. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's the incentive, you're not going to get it.
Well, let's say, for instance, the tax rate in a particular sector is 30%. Right, and the turnover of that sector is a million rands. We would have received, I mean, effective tax rate would be different, but let's say we would have received 300,000 rand in tax. We're giving that sector a rebate or some special incentive, maybe say 25% tax rate for that sector. So we're foregoing 5% of a million rands. We're foregoing 50,000 rands. Now, we could have received that 50,000 rands had we not given that incentive. So, therefore, it's actually a cost on the business. Yes, that's why we made a distinction between expenditure and tax expenditure, and we combined them and then we put total resources dedicated for industrial policy initiatives. Are there any other questions on that particular one, Chair? Okay. Thank you. Let's now turn our attention to one of the first sectors we look at, which accounts for significant component of overall spending, and that's manufacturing. So manufacturing has been a consistent focus of the South African government since 1994, and even prior to 1994. What we have on this table, summary of some of the key manufacturing-oriented industrial policies since 1994, and on the right-hand side we have the objectives. So what do these programs seek to achieve? And we've got a wide array of objectives. The strong emphasis on the manufacturing sector for South Africa is premised on the view that the manufacturing sector is really critical in a country's process of industrialization. This is because, one reason for this is because the sector has very strong linkages with other sectors in the economy. When I say linkage, I mean that, say for instance, you're producing automobiles in this country, and you've got Toyota in Durban and VW in the Eastern Cape, and they'll want, you know, they want to set some components to produce vehicles, and they may increase demand from other sectors, and they may want leather for seats, and they may want rubber for tires, and this is a very general example. So that sector links a lot of other sectors in the economy. So supporting the manufacturing sector, or both in the manufacturing sector, has impact on many other sectors in the economy. So that's one example, for instance, why the manufacturing sector gets a lot of emphasis, and it's believed that the sector contributes to growth across the economy, high employment and exports. Exports is quite important for Africa, given our deficit in our trade accounts. The most prominent manufacturing incentive since 1994 has been the MIDP, so that's the Motor Industry Development Program, which my colleague Ben will speak to in a few moments. And yeah, I'll discuss it in the next sector. So manufacturing, if you look at resources dedicated to the sector, we notice the split between expenditure, which is on the budget, and tax expenditure, which is off the budget, but through tax incentives support to firms. In 20-year period, we look at this amounts to 84.4 billion in current rands. So that's the amount we're dedicated to the sector, manufacturing overall. It's important to note over here that expenditure is a larger component compared to tax expenditure, so most of it is actually on the budget. How has the sector performed since 1994? The manufacturing sector has grown considerably since 1994, the transition to democracy. It's now 1.6 times larger than what it was in 1994. And the contribution to GDP has averaged 15% between 1994 and 2008, which is, excuse me, quite significant. However, since 2008, contribution to GDP has actually declined, and now averages around 13.5%. What this indicates is that the manufacturing sector has grown slower than the rest of the economy, especially since the financial crisis. Look at exports from the manufacturing sector. They've performed particularly well since 1994. It took the country less than 6 years to double our total manufacturing exports. And this may suggest the success of the country's policies to ensure successful reintegration into the world economy since 1994.
Yes.
Okay. So what I've got over here, these are real numbers, but yes, over here, which gives you a consistent equation of total manufacturing exports for the sector over time.
That means that even if you take out the impact of inflation, even if you take out the impact of inflation, because often if you compare numbers over a long time period, and you've had inflation, say, like we've had 4-6% a year, it seems like it's growing if you put the nominal numbers, the actual numbers that you report. But if you want to take into account, you know, price changes, like a car will increase in price every year, if we look at what we're exporting, we're not taking into account those price changes, we actually take into account what it actually costs each year. So in real terms, they've been grown. So this is also one of the reasons why we use real numbers in economic analysis. So I think the one thing I want to stress maybe to the honourable members is the difference between sort of financial and accounting analysis and to the kind of understanding how sectors perform, they actually should do real analysis. Because you could say experts have been grown in the sector, but then somebody can come and say, but they're actually not looking at how prices change and how the prices are increased. So we're actually not exporting more cars, we're just exporting more expensive cars every year. So it just looks like exports are increasing. But what we are showing here is that there's been a really large, significant growth in the sector in real terms, which means that we're actually exporting more cars and components as well, which reflects the productivity and the underlying growth of the sector in the economy. So I hope I'm not confusing you further by saying that.
I don't know if I'm jumping the gun, Honourable Chair, but I just want to check within the presentation as to also compare figures as to your imports as well, because you are showing us a graph of your exports currently and how it has grown through the years. But what I will also like to see is the comparison between the exports and the imports as well. Is it in the presentation as well, or?
No, we haven't looked at imports. We've looked at the objectives of these industrial policy initiatives, and specifically at growth, exports, with a stated objective, employment and investment.
Now, would you like this office to provide us with that information maybe later in writing? Are you able to do that for us?
We can. You can just submit the request to Professor and we can do this.
Okay.
Do some additional work on this.
Okay. Let somebody make a submission. Alright. Thank you very much. Shall we proceed?
Thank you. So we've noted that it's taken only 5 years for the sector in terms of its exports to recover to pre-financial crisis levels. So over here you see a steady, significant drop over a short period of time. And this is when you have the financial crisis which started in the US and then affected the rest of the world. And manufacturing exports have recovered quite strongly since then. This gap between the green and the gray line, which is very narrow over here and widens over time, it essentially shows the dependency or significant contribution of the manufacturing sector to the automobile sector in terms of exports. So that gap over there accounts for exports from the auto sector, which my colleague Randall will speak to in a few moments. So I think it's important to note that while the manufacturing sector's contribution to GDP has declined over time, which we noted over here, as an export level, it still plays a very important role in maintaining the country's balance of payments. So exports as members also the imports, exports versus exports versus imports, the manufacturing sector plays an important role, and this contributes to the relative brand strength, and this is quite important in that respect. And what this also indicates is the recovery of exports, the significant growth in exports relative to the growth in GDP, also indicates more higher value added goods from the manufacturing sector, and that's important to bear in mind. If we look at manufacturing employment from 1994 up to 2014, which is the most recent data we have, the manufacturing sector has been, in terms of employment, has been in consistent decline since we moved, or since the transition to democracy. The sector usually employed 1.43 million people in 1994, accounting for 14%, which is quite significant of total employment in the African economy. And this has fallen to 1.1 million people by 2014. Most of the data we have, which is only 10% of total formal employment. So on the employment side, sector has actually shed a lot of jobs. Given that employment creation is a key objective of several manufacturing-oriented programs and incentives, I think it should be noted that the sector has become less reliant on labor. So while the sector has grown and exports have grown, the sector is employing less people. So the sector is less reliant on labor. And we're seeing increases, significant increases in investment, and that's this graph over here over time. So there's significant increase in investment, there's growth in the sector, there's increasing exports, but there's less employment. Now this suggests that the sector has limited potential to create jobs in the economy. If we decompose employment in the sector, so if we look at the composition of employment between highly skilled, skilled, and semi-skilled workers, what we note over here is that there are less skilled and semi-skilled people in the sector compared to highly skilled over time. So if you look at the deep graph, so the very dark one over here, like the very the top bar over here, so the lighter gray and the green have decreased the share of total employment, whereas the darker gray in the bottom, which is highly skilled, has actually increased the share of total employment, which means that growth in the sector is associated with less highly skilled and low skilled workers and more highly skilled workers. This presents a bit of a challenge and may suggest that the sector is not likely to absorb semi-skilled and low-skilled individuals who primarily make up the unemployed in our country. And so this overall decline in employment levels in manufacturing is not unique to South Africa. This is across the world. You've seen manufacturing resurgence over the past couple of years in many developed countries as well. However, it's been a different type of manufacturing in the sense that it's labor-intensive and more capital-intensive. However, at the same time, I think it's important to note that it's possible that growth in the manufacturing sector may result in increased employment in other sectors due to linkages in the economy. We spoke about linkages earlier on. You have the auto sector, which may increase demand for liquid goods because the nation peaks, and you may see increase in employment in those sectors as they provide inputs into the manufacturing process. In answer, I've already spoken about manufacturing investment, which grew significantly and then again has fallen quite significantly after the Austrian financial crisis and has somewhat recovered, since then. I think more recent numbers will indicate where this recovery continues. I'm going to hand over to my colleague Brandon, who's going to take us through the next two sectors.
Thanks, Chairperson and Rashad. So, as Rashad has already pointed out, I'm going to focus on industrial centres relating to specific sectors. So, there were two specific sectors that we did cover, and I'm going to start off by outlining a bit of the history behind the rationale for industrial support in the sector and the actual incentive introduced. Then I'll give you a sense for the cost of the support over time, and end off with an overview of the sector's performance over the same period. So the first sector we focused on was that of motor vehicles and components. Now, just to give you some history of what the sector looked like in 1994, the automotive sector was relatively small at the time, inwardly focused, labor-intensive, employed around 111,000 workers, and following the transition to democracy in 1994, there was a feeling that the industry would need some time to adjust to the liberalization. It was realized that some manufacturers may be left exposed to foreign competition if we liberalize too quickly, for example. So the thinking was that we needed some kind of support to place our local manufacturers on a level footing with global competitors. So this comes to the discussion of industrial support measures to aid in South Africa's reintegration. Some of the objectives of these measures were to introduce to protect existing jobs and to allow the sector the time necessary to restructure, as I said. The strategy, as I say, at that stage was to adjust production in such a way that the range of products was narrowed. And the idea was to produce those products on a larger scale for export, so with all other components being imported. Now, the first major package of incentives introduced, as Rashad referred to earlier, was 1995. The Motor Industry Development Program, MIDP, was introduced. Now, the MIDP was a set of incentives and subsidies targeting the automotive sector. It was modified and extended on several occasions, but essentially, it protected the local industry by placing high tariffs on already bought vehicles. So if you were importing all vehicles into the country as a manufacturer, you had some level of protection because of tariffs. Other measures included providing local manufacturers with tax credits for importing vehicle components to use in domestic production. So this is where the value add angle comes in. So what this effectively allowed local manufacturers to do was they'd import components at a duty-free rate and then sell them into the local market, but inclusive of that duty-free, the duty-free rate. So that gave them a significant advantage compared to, say, for example, foreign competitors. The MIDP ran from 1995 to 2012, after which it was essentially modified and renamed the Automotive Production and Development Program, APDP. In all terms, the APDP encouraged local manufacturers to expand existing operations. It promoted value-added production and targeted investment through tax rebates, which were funded from the custom duties collected from the industry. It's important to note that on the automotive sector side, the incentives extended well beyond the APDP, MIDP. A range of incentives were offered by, have been offered by provincial, national, local governments. So we're simply focusing on the two primary incentive packages. At this stage, the APE is intended to run until 2050. So taking a look at the support for the motor vehicles and components sector, the sector received about $324.2 billion, and again, this is in 2015-60 rand, so inflation has been accounted for here, these are real rand, and this is over the period 1995 to 2014-15. Now, this figure actually accounts for about 60% of the total industrial support covered in this report. So all the numbers we've added up in this report, 60% of the support can be attributed to this one sector, motor vehicles and components. It's a relatively high proportion, is in part due to the limited role industrial policy played in other sectors for the fifth decade of democracy, which I think Richard mentioned earlier. So as you can see in the graph, the vast majority of the support has come in the form of tax rebates, so around 97%. The full report provides further breakdown of this expenditure if you're interested. I think it's more of a deep dive into each and either the MIDP, APDP, etc. Now, an important point worth mentioning is that while we're discussing the expenditure or support provided for these incentives, it's also important to look at the income generated by the sector. For example, what was the amount of income received by cars in the form of customs duties through the importation of motor vehicles and components? So if we look at the period from 2007-08 to 2014-15, stock collected 81.5 billion rand in customs duties. That's just from importing vehicles and components. So another way to put it would be to say that over this particular period, about 90% of the funds used to support the industry were actually collected in the form of customs duties. That information you can find in the full the actual full technical report. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry to jump in. Just if you go back to your pie chart again, just to be careful as well, because in table 5 we're only looking at a period 2007-08 to 2014-15. That was the easiest available SARS data. We didn't go back to 1995. So in the table in the full report, that's only for a portion of that period. So we're not looking at that total 324.2 billion there. We're looking at for vehicles and transport. We're looking at 90 billion spent from 2007-08, so to the current period. And so when Brandon's saying that 89% of that could have been covered by the import or the customs duties, that was an amount of about 81.5 billion from 2008 to 2014-15. I'm just saying this because I know when people see different rates and things in real numbers or nominal numbers, things get confusing. So just to point out, so when people reading, they do take account of that. When we're talking about incomes from duties, we're talking about different dates, just because of the data constraints we have. So.
And I understand that it's done, and you've been given a reason, but with respect, if that is the case, that you don't have data for other years, then not to be consistent and give us the same data for the same years, because it's going to confuse us. Not that it's going to confuse me, it's going to be confusing. Mm-hmm. That's not the same thing.
Alright, so then into the performance of the sector. The automotive sector has grown steadily since 1994, as you can see in the graph there, but has become yet labor intensive. Okay, so much like the manufacturing sector more broadly. The latest data suggests that the growth may have in fact stagnated. This is in part due to the poor and uneven global recovery following the financial crisis. So the figure you can see shows that the industry is approximately 2.5 times the size of what it was in 1994. Then this is when measured by its gross value add. So it's grown from about 11.1 billion rand in 1994 to 27.8 billion in 2014. And that, just to be clear, that's an actual index. All it does is really it shows growth in real terms. So using 1994 as the basis, if that's what you feel, it's 100, you can determine how much the industry has grown over time using the index. Another additional point on the previous slide was that the value of industry exports in 1994 has actually reflected a very similar upward trajectory. However, the extent to which the introduction of the MIDP has contributed to this is unclear and is not necessarily covered in our report. So, looking at employment, a poignant global trend in the industry has been the move towards mechanization in the production process. This is reflected in the figure above, which shows that employment in the industry peaked in the early 1980s and has declined since. I'm specifically referring to that green line, which shows you formal employment numbers. Now, despite a brief increase in employment after reintegration in 1994, the decline has proven to be quite resilient. Employment levels at the end of 2014 were under 88,000, and this compared with the 1982 peak level of approximately 148,500. So since 94, the sector actually shed about 23,364 jobs by the end of 2014. What this has done is that it has changed the labor intensity of the industry with the focus on mechanization. So since the introduction of the MIDT in 1995, the capital-to-labor ratio, that's the gray line you can see on the graph, which basically measures the amount spent on machinery and equipment inputs relative to the amount spent on labor, has increased substantially. So, in other words, manufacturers are increasingly spending a lot more on machines than they are on labor. Employment levels are currently declining towards their 1970 levels, and this trend is likely to continue as advances in production technology promote further productivity gains from the use of capital. Okay, so turning our attention now to the second sector that we focused on, is the clothing and textile sector. The sector experienced a period of decline in output from its peak in the early 1980s. Now, like many sectors in the pre-94 period, it was inwardly focused. However, the value of the exports were a little stronger than what we saw in the automotive sector, but still relatively low compared with some of its some other international or different countries. At the time, the sector employed about 180,000 workers, and the sector was characterized by marginally less protection than what was the case for other sectors, including the automotive sector. The sector was fairly open. The objectives in providing industrial support were to enhance the competitiveness of the sector, so this was specifically to focus on improving quality, cost, and delivery of domestic manufacturers. One of the other issues that the clothing sector had was that there was an apparent anti-export bias in the early 90s, which seemed to stem from unusually high import tariffs. So it was very difficult for manufacturers to import raw materials, add value in their export. So one of the goals of introducing the industrial policy was to try and counter that anti-export bias. So to look at the specific policies introduced, the first was the duty credit certificate scheme, or the DCCS. And that was introduced to basically offer tax credits on raw material imports to manufacturers who increase their exports. So this was directly addressing that anti-export bias. The DCCS scheme then evolved into the Textile and Clothing Industry Development Program, the DCIDP, which determined the level of the tax credit according to the type of export. So if you were exporting clothing, you would receive higher rebate. If you were exporting fabric, slightly lower, and then yarn, lower still. So again, not only focus on exports, but also value add. Then, to encourage investment in the sector directly, the DGI initiated the Clothing and Textile Competitiveness Improvement Program, CTCIP, in 2009. Its introduction followed a prolonged period of decline in the local industry, which was primarily due to the growth in Asian apparel exports and some other domestic issues. The program provides grants to a group of linked entities within the sector, which they refer to as clusters. So the idea behind funding clusters as opposed to individual companies is that coordinated groups, group initiatives, have a better chance of achieving lasting competitiveness gains rather than funding an individual company. So that was the thinking behind the CTCIP. So what was the cost of support for the clothing and textiles industry? Government support amounted to at least 40.8 billion in 2015-16 rand over the period of 1994-95 to 2014-15. This accounts for about 7.3% overall industrial support expenditure covered in our report. In terms of rankings, it places the sector, I think, in third place, the third most highest funded support sector, which is certainly not insignificant. Again, the total resources dedicated to the sector should be considered in relation to the income from customs which you receive. Again, now we're switching to the slightly different time frames, but from 2007-08 to 2014-15, it has collected 36.9 billion rand customs fees from this particular sector. And when comparing it to the same time frames and the support provided over the same time frame, the revenue amounted to about 2.5 times the resources dedicated to the sector. So basically what I'm saying, the customs duty form covered the support provided over that particular period. Looking at the performance of the sector, we're focusing on growth now. After market growth in the real output of the sector from 1970 to 1981, a fairly persistent downward trend ensued until about 2005. As of 2001, the sector had grown only 16% in real terms since 1970. At this point, the sector was approximately 36% smaller than at its peak in 1981. So, from this low base, there was a nice growth spurt between 2005 to 2010 of approximately 35%. This corresponded quite nicely with the introduction of TCIDP, although, again, it's not necessarily clear what role the study played in that growth. Maybe due to a range of other factors. However, the last few years we've seen the sector decline marginally, and that seems to coincide with the TCIDP introduction, but again, modality there is very clear. Looking at exports in the sector, similar to what was observed in the other sectors, the reintroduction of products into the global economy lifted the sector's exports. The figure you can see shows that the real value of exports had increased by about 50% as of 2001 compared with 1994. Interestingly, if you remember the previous graph, growth in exports occurred over the same period in which the overall output for that farming industry declined. So this suggests some degree of substitution, which manufacturers were selling increasingly into foreign markets relative to domestic markets. This trend, however, seems to have mostly reversed since 2001 with exports plummeting, reaching a low in 2012, at which point the value of exports is 64% lower than that of peak. And this is despite the introduction of the TIDP. The interpretation here is that since 2001, it appears as if the industry has grown on the back of strong domestic sales, and I say that because that 2005-10 period, the industry actually experienced a nice growth, but exports were plummeted, which suggests that domestic sales are probably driving that growth. Thanks to employment, and final slide on the sector. Employment in the sector is closely tracked to your output right up until about the mid-1990s. So as the output of the industry declined, so too did the employment levels. However, this has changed beyond the mid-1990s. The sector's employment levels appear to have decoupled from its real output. So despite the sector's strong growth over the period from 2005 to 2010, employment has continued to decline. with the PCIDP and CPCR being unable to reverse this trend. So this corresponds with the movement that Rashad alluded to and I alluded to towards the increased use of capital in the production process. Productivity gains these days are being driven by additional capital as opposed to additional labor. All indications are that this trend is likely to continue into the future. So, to conclude, South Africa has introduced a wide range of industrial development policies and programs, which have been implemented in a number of sectors. It's critical for Parliament to consider both efficiency and the effectiveness of these programs. The PBO estimates $291 billion or $476.7 billion in 2015 rand have been dedicated to industrial development. You can see the breakdown between expenditure and tax expenditure there. There was an increase in expenditure, particularly since the adoption of the National Industry Policy Framework. The majority of the support has been for manufacturing, automobiles, and clothing textiles. Manufacturing and automobile sectors have grown since 1994 with an increase in exports, but employment levels have fallen. Clothing and textiles have recovered marginally after a prolonged slump. However, as I just pointed out, employment levels are falling and will probably continue to fall in that sector. Thank you.
For the honourable members, you have been listening to a very important and interesting briefing by the budget office, budget office officials. And indeed they have shared very important information with us. Information on the cost and outcomes of industrial development, touching on government's commitment to industrial development, touching on the development of policies, and also touching on development of programs, and in touch on programs, the programs obviously talking manufacturing, motor vehicle and components, clothing and textiles, but the presentation also touched on the appropriation of budget according to government priorities, appropriation of funds from national budget and the tax incentives, and they've also tried to define our role as a parliament, looking at the focusing on alignment of the budget with government priorities and also alignment of the outcome with value for money, effectiveness. You must correct me quickly if I'm misrepresenting you. I'm just showing you how fast I had to learn from you this morning. But then, I want us to then reflect on this presentation and then raise clarity-seeking questions. I know there were interjections which I think were necessary because we didn't want to lose out, at that stage of the presentation. But then I'm now handing over to you, honourable members, for clarity-seeking questions. All right. Sorry, as Professor Mohammed would like to...
If I can ask the indulgence, I wanted to check with the Honourable Chair and members if maybe giving a bit more background would be useful. I think I'm just gauging responses to talk a bit more about what's happened in the global economy and also in terms of the importance of industrial policy. Because I mean, part of what we're trying to do is to look at translating the finance side into economic outcomes and impact. And I think if you give me, 5-6 minutes, I can try maybe and add a bit to that. I'm at your pleasure, so you can refuse as well. I could come in later after people have asked questions. Thank you very much. I'll try not to take too much of the time so that we can get more questions or clarity and comments. Just to say that, the period that we covered from 1994 onwards was a period of huge change in South Africa, I also want to mention the huge changes in global economy. The one big thing, because one of the things we always look at, and it's really important to look at in South Africa, is the impact on employment. Now, if you look at what happened in the global economy through the 80s, and we see a few effects, especially from the 90s onwards, is the increased integration of Asian economies, especially China and India, into the global economy. And that, in a sense, you can think about it as almost doubling the workforce of the global economy that used to be fairly separate. China, related to the kind of shift towards more kind of market-driven socialism, and India also in part of their wanting to play a much larger role in the economy. And so there has been a huge competition for developing manufacturing capability in the Asian economies. And you see that affected Latin America and Africa quite a bit as developing countries in that race. And what I want to stress is that if we look at sectors where we've actually, like, especially autos, where we've provided support for a longer time, we actually are in a much stronger competitive position. I think we're still struggling, but I think that's the one thing I wanted to say about changes in the global economy. Linked to that change of employment is that in many economies responding to the growth in the global workforce, especially the impact of cheaper labor from countries like China, other East Asia countries, but also South Asia, countries like South Africa, but this has been a global phenomenon, have increased outsourcing. And so when we see that shift to more highly skilled workers as a proportion of total workforce in many of our manufacturing sectors, it reflects also outsourcing with the growth of things like private security services and clean services. Workers who used to be mine workers, work in manufacturing plants, used to work in universities and other places, now are recategorized as being part of business services in the services sector. What that also meant is that if you look at, especially in autos with metal workers, the career path of a metal worker has changed because a large part of the workforce who used to be involved in things like cleaning and other services, they are now outsourced. So they don't have the career trajectories, the benefits, the abilities to go and be trained in that. But that's another issue. But I think I wanted to raise this issue linked to manufacturing employment, and it's affected everybody, and it's a global phenomenon. So when we see that decline in employment, part of it is linked to increased mechanization and growing capital intensity in sectors, even in clothing, but it's also linked to a global phenomenon. And so when we think about spending money to support employment in a sector, we should also be cognizant of those changes. And the second change in the global economy that I wanted to talk about was increased concentration, and especially concentration along global value chains. And what we've seen since the 90s has been an unprecedented number of mergers and acquisitions in the global economy that is concentrated, where concentration has now moved from national economies like the US or Europe as a region, and Japan dominating, say, part of Asia, to where they actually want to dominate more and more global markets. And that's been a huge phenomenon, and it's also occurred where firms have restructured around how they control global value chains. And so the role we play, and often most trade in the world now, is through, not through sort of free market trade between one firm versus another firm, but it's between firms within global value chains. But if we want to keep playing a role in the global economy and a competitive role, we often need to be integrated into these global value chains. And there, the kind of investments we make through, say, the MIDP or the APDP plays a huge role, because it means that we basically move, instead of our technology and innovation and what we can do, with the rest of the value chain. If we start reducing that, we start falling behind, and then the lead companies, say Mercedes-Benz or Toyota, will turn towards another country and say, how are your how are your auto plants fitting into the value chain? Are they successful? So I think it's the kind of issues linked to long-term economic development. I mean, I think if you look at the literature on innovation and technology, there's a shift away from talking about sort of state and market to saying that innovation and technology is something that is collective, where the state and private players act and work together, and it's also cumulative. It happens over a period of time, and that through that support, and linked to that, you know, the support that the state provides during an upturn in the global economy is very different and means something very different in downturn. And we've seen this in the developed countries, in Japan, the US, the countries that are sort of having at the forefront of manufacturing. They've argued that if there hasn't been that kind of support from states, there would have been a much greater loss of jobs and capacity in manufacturing in the downturn. And so the incentives which are meant to provide, you know, certain goals that government may have end up actually being almost something that supports your ability to survive and your cash flow in the downturn. And we've seen the global economy going into serious downturn from 2007 and 2008. And unfortunately, that was also the period when we actually decided that we were going to provide more comprehensive support through the National Industrial Policy Framework. So we have a very difficult time as a team gauging the success of the support provided, because it happened at the beginning of the downturn. If we had provided the support at the beginning of the upturn, it may actually have led to more jobs and also much more growth and exports. Fortunately, it was supported by, we did see growth in exports, and we have seen some shift in value added in the economy. The final thing, without taking up too much time, before I move on, just to reinforce this idea of the value chain and participating in it and keeping your abilities aligned with the value chain. There's a really interesting story where when Steve Jobs was still alive, he was in a public forum with President Obama. And President Obama asked him, why don't you produce the iPhone in the U.S.? Sorry, I just need to drink some water. And President Obama was trying to put him on the spot to say, you know, you're just trying to make money, use cheap labor in China, and it doesn't make sense to come back, and you can charge, you know, a few dollars more, but make it in the U.S. And the response that Steve Jobs was a really interesting one, and I think useful for us. He used an example of when the iPhone shifted from a plastic screen to a glass screen, and he said, you know, we did that in China over a period of 3 months. It was a major design and engineering shift for the production process, but we could do it in China in 3 months. It has taken us more than a year to do that in the U.S. And he used the word ecology. He said it was the ecology that had been built over a period of time in the business, in terms of the linkages, in terms of the institutional support, in terms of the supply firm, etc., that now China has the ability. And I think what we managed to do with the MIDP and longer-term support to autos is we provided an engineering, a design, a safety, and many other things linked to the ecology of how the auto industry runs and how it fits into the global value chains. To the point where we now see interest from, say, Chinese and Indian, possibly Indian, I would go into that, manufacturers wanting to set up either autos or truck or minibus facilities in South Africa. So I think that's for me, is an important issue in thinking about the incentives and support. I think the challenge is, you know, is in how we measure this thing of, are we providing support and these things would have happened anyway? So that's a big thing Rashad raised. And I think there we have to really hone in our skills with DPME and the DPI to say, you know, what is the program and what do you want to do and how do you measure the outcomes, and have clear short-term goals, but also not take our eye off the long-term game. Because in manufacturing, it's all about the long-term game. And the importance, as Rashad mentioned, of manufacturing is that it ends up being an engine of growth that can shift your growth path in a much different way because you're building linkages. And in South Africa, what we see is we've had services growth outperform manufacturing growth, but it's actually been, a lot of it's been driven by the financial sector and growth in jobs, it's been business services and retail trade services. If we had a much larger growth in manufacturing, we would have had much more productive services and we had a very different small business what's the footprint. You know, we would have had very different kinds of small businesses related to support to bigger manufacturing firms. So, but I think the importance there, and that is also a hugely difficult thing to measure. So I think, you know, in doing this kind of report, I think what we can do over time, because I'm sure we'll have to come back to you and talk about, you know, the actual appropriation, how state money is being spent, and those things, and looking at what's happening in industry and manufacturing, I think the challenge for us is to be able to be sharper in saying where we see money making an impact, but also being able to say that there just are long-term things that are hard to measure, but we think that this money is making a positive contribution in this sense. One in upturn, one in downturn, etc. So, over time, we can probably develop a much sharper, more focused way of presenting these kinds of reports to you as well. So that's something that I think we can work on. Yeah, I'm going to stop there because I've taken more time than I planned to. I've got a few more things to say and it may come up in the question and discussion time. Thank you very much, Jay.
So far, we've seen a display of passion on these matters before us. But thank you very much and for that additional information. Information is of value, you know. It will always be of good use. As long as you have it. That's why it's required that it must be knowledgeable and you are here to assist us in this regard. Now, honorable member, earlier I said let's reflect on the briefing and then you can then raise clarity-seeking questions. Over to the honorable member. Just to make sure that we do participate, I can also call you one by one. Yes, okay. Honorable Dr. Fink.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. Obviously, it's valuable information. I think the point I was making earlier is that it was more a lot technical, which was the point that I was making. So I didn't mean to say there's a problem with the information. So, I just want to get off that start with the Professor Mohammed. some interesting information came out with your input with regards to the outsourcing, which probably resulted in the decrease or the reduction in unemployment. Now, we have a policy here which aims to promote labor-intensive industries. But on the other hand, we have now been a move to outsourcing from insourcing, and hence the reason why is staff are not able to, or employees are not able to grow in the industry. So is that not problematic, and should that not be looked at in terms of, and then who should look at it? So can I just get a comment on that? We obviously, since 1994, are part of a global economy. However, our policies, I would like to ask a question, are our policies designed to participate in the global economy? In other words, because, for example, are our policies attracting or investment friendly? Are our policies promoting exports? Do we promote exports and that sort of thing? And then, still on your presentation, your input there, Professor Mohammed, the downturn, we talk about the downturn in the economy, sorry, in the global economy. Now, we have our own unique country that we live in, If our downturn, because we seem to have downturn every 6 months or actually more frequent than other countries, is our does our downturn take place more or less the same time as the rest of the globe? It might be a difficult question, but I just wanted to put that on the table. In regards to the presentation, the policy is obviously has good intentions. Now, any policy to benefit the country, in my view, should benefit one of the I'm supposed to be talking to you, sorry. Benefit the country. But don't we have a situation in our country, and I'm hoping it's not a political question, where too few people are benefiting, thanks for the permission, where too few people are benefiting from these sorts of policies that are aimed to benefit the entire country, but fewer people, not enough people are benefiting. We've seen it. I mean, let it not be political. You see that there are very few people benefiting. So, I'll also respond to you. And then, with regards to these policies, perhaps I believe it has been, over time, it has developed and evolved. But has it evolved to the extent that those objectives in 1994 are the same objectives that we have now, the same instruments, or the same objectives that were set in 1994 are the objectives that are necessary now? For example, we talk about high-value industries, exploit the country's natural resources. I'm not so sure if we really are, to what extent. So my question is, the objectives that were set, have they evolved enough to still benefit the citizens of this country? For example, if you look at the instance, one of them being your state ownership of some entities, we've seen what has happened there, what is happening there, and perhaps that needs to be looked at. If I go to slide number 9, this is the one that I was sort of talking about. You use the financial costs as economic costs. Now, in the economic cost sense, this is you mentioned something about using GDP multiplier. Now, is that the correct calculation, or should one not use, because later on in the slide, Chair, there was also mention made of inflation. I believe inflation might be, if we talk about GDP multiplier, then we talk about inflation as well. While I'm on that one, later on in the presentation, there's a comparison made between customs duty received versus the cost of these projects. Now, can I ask you at this point in time, because the cost of the programs, we use this real rands. Now, this customs duty income, is that real customs duty rands that is made, that is compared to the actual expenditure? I noticed in the methodology there are a few issues. For example, the classification is emphasized, but it's just a statement. Yeah, there's nothing we can do about it. It's just a disclaimer that has been made. Okay, so obviously, and economists normally do the same as weathermen. They give information, but they cannot guarantee it. Okay. On slide number 11. We know that small businesses should be make a substantial part of any economy. We see that there's a small portion allocated to small business, and which is indicated here. Is there now this is the policy that has been established. What do you believe, if you can give us another, that figure or the percentage should be, because suddenly it's looking at about 8% if I look at the figure, and a substantial amount to motor vehicle, right, sorry? Yeah, 38%. So, I believe that in economies, in Europe, some of the economies are made up of about, 90% or close to of SMEs. I want to mention at this point in time that I saw, now once I mentioned it in my introduction that it's technical, I still don't believe that this figure, which was quoted as for this Rio Grande, that has been quoted, it just actually gives an, it tries to confuse us, and it, as much as we understand, you've explained why you've converted, but I'm not so sure, because when we budget for actual nominal rands, we don't budget pay for this real rands and inflation and so forth, so perhaps it would also be, I understand it's given, yeah, the actual figure or the nominal figure, but the real figure, I just commented on that, and I felt that it might be trying to just put some a cloud or wool over my eyes, or others. Slide number 16. I've talked about this in this slide, this is where Rashad mentioned he spoke about using inflation, but in previous slide he spoke about using the GDP multiplier. So I just, you know, I'm not sure, maybe I just missed something there. But you know, you see, Jay, in the calculation of the real rand versus the nominal rand, what figure you use, and if it is the GDP multiply, why that and not the inflation? Honourable Chair, the question on slide number 18, it's again back to the decline in employment from 1994. and this example given is manufacturing. Is it consistent with total unemployment? The decline in others, the decline in your manufacturing, is it the same decline as the decline in the total unemployment for the economy, for the country? And the reason for this, I think you did mention it, but my question on this would be, is that not because manufacturing industries are using more or less, let's say, more technologically advanced industries rather than your labor-intensive industries? Is that not also one of the reasons? Okay, I'm nearly done there. Okay. Slide number 25. This also comes on the latest, but this, these different policies that introduce your DCCS, your TCIDP. Now, what was the value? Was there a substantial increase in the subsidy with, you know, using the different different policies, different methods of subsidy? And because I noticed in the later class that and you did touch on it in your presentation, and then the unemployment still decreased, so you know, why did we pursue it? And then lastly, Honourable Chair, on slide number, okay, now I asked this question, and so this is the one about the collection of 36.9 billion collected versus the comparison with the amount of expenditure. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you so much for your intervention. I will now call upon Honourable Member Lowe, to be followed by Dr. Madope, and then Honourable Member Chwaza. After Honourable Member Chwaza, we have Honourable Member Mark Lockley.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the presenters for the presentation, a very insightful presentation. And that's why I stopped you, because I wanted to capture most of the information to further do research on it, because it's worth looking into it. What I have captured over through the information, and while you were doing your presentation, I was just thinking to myself, is government, or are they going to look at this report as well? Because I think they have to look at this report that you have conducted, and to have a re-look at the industrial policy of South Africa. my question or my input would be, I don't have many questions here, Dr. Fick. You've taken over the role of Sheikh Imam today. So I won't have so many questions like Dr. Fick. It's just two or three. But what I want to say, want to ask in your report, or have you have done research on the following, your illicit trade and how it influenced the market and influenced your objectives as well, especially to the clothing and textile industry, and also obviously in your motor industries as well. Have you done extensive work or any research work on illicit trade? And also on you have mentioned in your presentation some parts on how many money a government gets back to tax and things like that. What I also like to see is to pay, how did these industries, how did illicit financial flows had an impact on this industry's growth, and its downfall, and have you done work on that aspect as well? Then there was an area where you talked about it's not extensive data or something. I don't know on which slide is it. From the beginning. Yeah. There's a part of incomplete data and so forth. How does that influence the outcomes and all of this? Because you have even mentioned in your presentation, transparency, fiscal transparency and so forth. So how does that influence the outcomes of all of these trade agreements? Dr. Fick has made mention about in terms of is this trade agreement just benefiting fewer individuals? Is it made just to benefit just fewer individuals? So in just have you done work to check into in terms of the incomplete data and stuff like that. Is it done purposely like that? I think that is also now okay. Thanks.
Okay. We don't see the chair. Thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks to Parliamentary Budget Office for the valuable information that they always give to us, well researched and really assisting us to have an input, you know, even in the committees, different portfolio committees when they are engaging them. And you have presented a very important subject for industrial policy, its performance and its funding and so on. And also my colleague Dr. Fick talked to a few people benefiting, you know. Yeah. And my colleague is attending to ask that question. Maybe it will also assist because I'm trying to travel with this industrial police. Is there anything wrong with South African industrial police? One may ask. We see in the reduction of employment and so on and so forth. Is it because of the policy itself? Or the start maybe was it wrong in its start, you know, because you have indicated to say that the industrial policy tended to focus on supply side, you know, and also in the beginning they focused on the macroeconomic rather than micro, and then later on try to go back and introduce us and so on to try like we made the point to focus on the macro, even the micro, because at the moment the the research, most of the researchers, as well as the South Africa, they were indicating that most of the jobs is in the public sector, as well as the small medium enterprises, rather than the big one. You know, maybe if we can get what is wrong with our policy at the moment, or it's just automatically happening that it doesn't produce jobs. But I wanted also to check around the issue of the unemployment, because we are talking about 1994, the country was coming from sanctions, and you are talking about the jobs, there were so many jobs, and by that time, the African government were not focusing on the larger population of the country when they were talking about jobs. It goes back to what my colleague was saying, few people benefiting, because even in your report, you are indicating that the African government they supported the development of domestic industries, but their main objective was to improve the position of the white population. You know, it was not like, if you're saying that jobs were created, blacks were like not existing. So now when the democratic government come and extend employment to all its citizens, is it not also the contribution of the reduction of jobs? Because if there was a cake like this, the effort that we try to, only people that were few people, and then the job was more, because it was targeted for the few people. But when the democracy came, everybody, the constitution of South Africa was catered for the employment, you know. And then that's why maybe the unemployment is rising, because now we're covering a lot of people rather than few people that were targeted before 1994. I would want you to comment on that, because when we look at the way we're looking at the things, to me, it may be the contributing factor, although the jobs should decrease for the entire population, because the target, as you indicated in your full report, the objective was to improve the position of the white population, not to improve the entire population, which is the majority are black. So I want you to comment on that, because I think it can have a contribution to this decrease of people getting jobs. Secondly, the time of the before 1994, there was no labor intensive, because blacks were on the road, you know, doing that unskilled labor there, you know. They were being used, the chunk of them, but not in the critical job, just as laborers. What I'm trying to take, I think my colleague speak raised that particular point. When the technology is increasing, you know, even in South Africa where there was sanctions, a lot of things were not used here, like technology was not that increased. Now we are having in the country people being replaced by machinery, you know, in doing the work. Even in the sugarcane field, you see the machines. Now they have taken the job that was being, you know, used by this labor intensive. And then we are saying now, no, maybe we blame the policy, or it's a technology that has come in the country and replace, you know, the people with the machinery. And also to think, because there is a EPWP, Expanded Public Works Program, that the government tried to make an intervention to say that, no, we must use labor intensive, you know. But while the government has made that particular intervention, we saw also this technology, alternative method in the building environment, being used also even there to replace the labor intensive type. Because when you use this alternative method in the building environment, it means to say that the work that was going to be done by maybe three months, and those people benefiting and labor intensive part, now it's being reduced. The work that was supposed to be done by 3 months, maybe now it's a month. It is a month, it's just a week. Is it not the technology that, and I don't know how we're going to balance this thing of machinery vis-a-vis the labor intensive. Maybe if you can share with us, or maybe in your research, to say that in order for the government really to still provide jobs, because most of the job is not like the problem of maybe sometimes it can be the policy, sometimes it's not the policy, it's the technology that we have inherited, that we are using also in the country, that has eroded all the jobs, you know, and then we are using machine. Because now even in the cleaning environment we have labor intensive, you see just one machine, one person just doing the cleaning, you know. So I don't know if my question is, do you think that maybe in future we are going to produce jobs even if there are no recessions, as the colleague was, you know, in the way that it was happening before the technology in the country, because we must look at that one. Lastly, I nearly say comrade chair, honorable chair, but we are all comrades because we are in the struggle for development. That's what it means to be a comrade. We are waging certain struggles that we want to achieve. Here we want to achieve the development in the country and the betterment of that. Yeah. No, this one is a fight. We are not fighting, Tina. We are operating and working for the betterment of our citizens. Because if you fight, you will just kill people, you know. Yeah, honorable chair, maybe if the parliamentary budget can assist us, maybe to really analyze this public, these industrial policies, whether is there anything that the government can do, and also to say how do we balance this machinery vis-a-vis the labor intensive approach in our projects, so that we create a more jobs on it. Thanks.
I'll come after you because I'm sharing. And okay, before me, okay. All right. Honorable Malana, were you saying you want to also? Okay.
Let me join my colleagues for welcoming the report. Quick to the issues that I wanted to raise. I understand that now most of the global sectors, they are intending, they are using the outsourcing method. There is this problem in South Africa of outsourcing versus labor brokers. If you can just clarify for us what is the difference between the two. Because I know most of the people are complaining about these labor brokers. The other issue my colleague has just raised with regards to our policies. Is there something wrong with it? And why they were changing it now and again? On page 25, we see that these policies have been changed many a time. Maybe they're trying to address the issue of labor force, but it seems as if it's just going down. Maybe there is something wrong that we're doing, or the educational system that we have is not addressing to the correct issues that affect our country. The last issue is with regards to the illicit trading. My colleague touched on it. You know, in South Africa, we are seeing, they are calling it Hong Kong, the dumping of things in South Africa. How is it affecting our economy? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Acting Chairperson. Yes, thanks to our colleagues in the Budget Office for their presentation. I just wanted to ask initially for an opinion. You initially said that you have to look at what is industrial policy and why do we have an industrial policy. Because if the main thrust of the industrial policy was to promote economic development, and not, as some would argue, to control economic development. Have we succeeded in what we set out to do? If it was 1996, our long-term goal there, have we achieved that? Because if our objective was to increase employment, from the figures you give us, it looks like we haven't achieved that. If we just look at the motoring industry, for example. Now, the figures you give us in the motoring industry, where the number of jobs has decreased over the period, you say it's because of outsourcing. But if that outsourcing is outsourced to a neighboring industry, one of the other industries within the country, then we may still have achieved the objective, because the increase in employment in that industry may have gone to such an extent that it way outweighs the drop in employment in a remote industry. I just think, for example, in terms of security, the security industry in this country has mushroomed since 1994. And surely, if at the time motor industries were employing their own security guards, for example, and they outsource it, obviously it's going to reduce the number of employment in the industry, but increase numbers elsewhere. Do you actually have those kind of figures, so that we can have a broader look? Because you see, if you're focused in on the motor industry, which might give us a bit of a skewed view of the bigger picture from that point of view, if you understand what I'm saying. You made some interesting comment, if I can just go to the first point in slide 6, where you say Parliament's role is to determine the outcomes of the programs of meeting these stated objectives, program effectiveness, but then on slide 10, as has been mentioned by two of my colleagues, you state the outcomes and benefits are challenging to observe and calculate. So how do we actually do that? If we can't observe and calculate, how do we determine if it's been effective or not? I know it's a sort of chicken and egg kind of question, but do you have any suggestions? How can we better achieve that objective as Parliament? How do we actually go about understanding or quantifying the effect? I know it's you've tried to explain the difference between the nominal rent and the real rent. And I understand what you're saying in terms of if one looks at a million rand in 1994 compared to today, is far more valuable. But there are reasons for that, quite apart from just inflation, because our currency drops at a level against other currencies at a hugely different rate to inflation because of other internal factors. Do you look at those as well? Do you bring those into the equation? The other point on slide 10, many programs do not have clear and explicit targets. This obviously says to me, when we as a government adopt a policy like this and start putting money in, that's a high-risk kind of situation, because there's no guarantee as to what we're going to get out for the money we put in. And what kind of risk assessment do we do on this up front? Or do we just say, look, this is a good idea, or it seems like a good idea at the time, as they say in the classics, and it turns out to be a very bad idea, do we just write it off and say, well, we miscalculated, let's move on. I just wanted to get, sorry, I know it's probably just the economic terminology that you use, and perhaps I'm not that au fait with, but when you speak of foregone revenue and tax expenditure compared to normal expenditure, am I understanding correctly? Expenditure would be what you have and what you give out, but tax expenditure might be what you are foregoing out of your possible tax return. Okay, so to me that wouldn't be expenditure, but you call it tax expenditure. Okay, I understand what you're saying. Now, when you, as Brandon said, that the when you look at the customs duty, customs and excise duty recoverable on things, and then it balances out again, you also factor in the other elements of tax that come into it. I mean, on every product you sell locally this year, VAT, whenever it happened, there's also income tax generated on the profits of the companies that are working. Do we actually get a benefit from the money that we putting out, or are we just balancing it off? Are we just sort of breaking even, as it were? What we get as a return, is that just balancing what we put in the first place? Because then there's no real benefit to fiscus as such. We might be benefiting something else. We might be enabling the economy to perform better, but there's no real benefit to the fiscus. Or is there actually a benefit to fiscus as well? Are we enabling the economy to that extent that we also have a flow back into the fiscus? I just wanted a couple of questions that I had. On slide 17, manufacturing exports 1994-2014, the dotted line at the top, which is manufacturing exports as share of GDP, whereas the other two on that particular graph, that's manufacturing exports as share of total exports, they both have recovered to their pre-financial crisis point, but the other one hasn't. That's still only about halfway there. Do you have an explanation for that? Is it just because, are we looking again at the automotive industry, or why is it that that share of the GDP hasn't recovered where the rest does seem to have? Maybe you can just give me an idea as to what goes on there. And then on slide 18, that gap that is shown there between the manufacturing employment, including and excluding the automotive industry, between where this graph starts, as I say, 1994 and 2014, that gap has narrowed. Does that mean that industries, apart from motoring or motor industry, have they grown, or has the motor industry shrunk? It's not apparent from the graph which way around it is, but the gap is obviously narrowed. And I just had a question as to why that was. Then on your manufacturing investment slide 20, it indicates a clear drop in financial investment when the financial crisis hit around about 2009. Then we have a fairly rapid climb up to about 2012. And then it tailed off again from 2012 onwards. Is there any reason for that you could suggest? Because it seems as though we were recovering pretty well and then suddenly all went flat. I just wanted to ask a question on slide 23. Brendan, you indicated that the motor vehicles and components growth has grown by 2.5 times from 1994 to 2014. But on page 18 of the full report, there's a thing that says it's grown by 1.6 times. So are we talking about something different there? Or maybe you can explain why one says 1.6 and one says 2.5. Maybe we're looking at something different. I'm not sure whether I'm comparing the wrong thing. Not looking at the latest items. Then just a question I had in the clothing and textile industry. When we look at the growth from 1994 to 2014, we have a growth spurt that runs from 2004 to 2010. It didn't seem to have been immediately impacted by the financial crisis. Do you have a comment on that? Because our growth seems to carry on past the 2010 mark, almost 2011 if I'm seeing it wrong correctly, but as the financial crisis hits 2008-2009, I think growth just carried on. Slide 27. Yes. And then again, I just had a question. Once again, because our growth was, we had a fairly straight growth line from 2004 to 2010, but if you look at the employment graph for the same sector between 2004 and 2010, it's steady decline. And I thought, is there some correlation between those two? How is it that the industry was growing so much in that sector, and yet the employment was falling? Did it become particularly mechanized, or was it getting computerized in the sector at the time? And are we as a government looking at any way in compensation? Because obviously as we get more and more technologically advanced, machines are taking over from human beings, so we're making use of computers, they're more accurate and they're more consistent, whatever else. But are we looking at how do we employ the people who now fall off because there's now a computer doing his or her job? And if so, what are we looking at? Where are we going to pick up that employment? I mean, we can't just put everybody into an EVWP scheme. It's not practical and it's not sustainable. Thank you. I think that's all I have. Thanks very much.
Another Bruno.
Thank you, Jay. No, what I wanted to find out, Jay, I don't know if I'm out of order. I just want to check. This report, Is it the first time that they are presenting the report to Parliament? Because I'm just concerned to some of the findings that have come out in the report, particularly on the motor industry and so forth. Because I think 2 or 3 months ago, or a month ago, a Toyota plant was opened in Durban. And if this plant is not going to give jobs, why continue opening these plants? So I just want to find out if this report of this nature, is it the first time they are presenting it to us, or if they present this report, or as your mandate stretch that you can report this report to National Treasury and so forth. And then also, I had another one, and then in this particular report, did you also make recommendations as to opposed to, you understand, what needs to happen? Because that is what I also like to see, because you focus on giving us a big picture, but as to people that have done extensive research on this particular subject, to give also recommendations as to what needs to happen forward. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, Honourable Law, add to that question of Toyota, which is an important investment. The other investments in the automotive industry that have taken place in the past 2-3 years, whether you're talking BMW or Mercedes-Benz or General Motors, etc., there have been investments from the sector itself, but we don't seem to benefit in terms of employment and growth in the GDP input. So, if you haven't looked into that, that's fine. But we are saying go look into those investments as well in the automotive industry, and let's come back and re-look into that. There may be other investments in other sectors that we might not necessarily be aware of. So look into all those investments. Because linked to that, I was going to ask the question. If you're saying in paragraph 41 of this CICA document, among other things that you're talking about, is that the cooperative relationship between private sector and government is to allow for better identification of potential opportunities, etc. And you go on to say this may incentives themselves that government is giving might nudge the private sector into taking risks. Now here are government incentives. Here is the automotive industry probably taking risks and putting a lot more money of its own into it. But why are the other sectors that are receiving these incentives not taking these kinds of risks? So that they can help, they can expand and grow the economy and create jobs. Why is that so? Is there something else that we don't know, that we don't see? Either in the industrial policy itself, as some members have said, is there something wrong or probably weak in our industrial policy? Implementation possibly, or something else? But it would be interesting to know why would these sectors accept incentives from government? And just use these incentives to maintain themselves because that what seems to be the other side of it. Is government giving money to people who are reserving their own funds and not contributing into the economy? Remember, we are told there is something between 6 billion and a trillion grand in the private sector that lies there unused, liquid cash, forget the assets. But they sustain themselves with government incentives and not their own money, and they are not expanding. Why is that so? I wanted to also get clarity on slide 7, that just last part of it where you say that the industrial policy and public finance that goes with it might give rise to unintended consequences as well. If you could explain that a little better. Is it domestic consequences? Is it related to profit distortions in trade, etc.? What does that mean? The you have indicated on slide 10 that you don't have access to information from the outside of the equation, from the private sector. What kind of information are the chambers of commerce and industry holding? This kind of information that you are able to get from the department, you can't get from that. And there may be other specials that are players in the private sector. The BBCs and the Black Business Council and so on. On slide 21, I raised this question. I wanted to make this comment that, we're talking about a very huge part of our economy, manufacturing, incentives, and investment, etc., and so on. And you make a very valid observation that the benefits, we must be careful that the benefits accruing from the industrial policy and public finance are not concentrated. I want to start off by commenting that you must be careful not to be fixated on this expression, which is now popular in politics, that there are only a few people who are benefiting, and by implication, it points to individuals within the ruling party, which we are not disputing. But you must be careful not to be fixated to the extent that we fail to see the bigger picture, or if we don't, we are not failing to see the bigger picture, we are deliberately covering the bigger picture. Because the crux of the matter here is that the structure of the South African economy is such that the means of production are still located in a few monopoly capital industries.
actually owned by whites. It's a fact. So to always hide behind a few individuals among the ruling party benefiting is sometimes very disingenuous. And we must be careful not to be fixated on that to cover up the bigger vision. Linked to that is what Honorable Madoba was raising earlier on in a slightly different manner. The fact that the economy of this country was concentrated in urban, largely white areas, to almost the total exclusion of the former Bantustan areas, with huge black population. And when I say the huge black population, I include the Indians with colors because they were in their Bantustan of their own. And they are part of the black population. We must never lose sight of it when we talk about these big economic issues of our country. And that still affects largely the black population. So this is a fixation of the few individuals benefiting is very dangerous. Maybe the question that we must then begin to look at is how do we use the industrial policy to spread across the geography of our land to take into cognizance those that have been historically locked up in and dumped in the Bantustan with very little opportunity for employment, very little opportunity for economic activity, and so on. Do our IDZ and SEZ begin to address that? If they do, to what extent? If they don't, what else are we supposed to do to spread this economy across the geography of our land, wherever possible? Lastly, Chairperson, maybe not lastly, one of the things that I think we must clarify is whether the current industrial policy and other pieces of legislation do indeed open up space for linkages between the bigger players in the economic sector, in manufacturing sector, broadly speaking, and the SMME and cooperative sector, to the extent that there can be mutual growth of both sectors, and therefore a contribution to economic growth and the creation of jobs. Remember, we keep on saying that the SMMEs and cooperatives are today the largest drivers of economic growth and employment and job creation. I'm told the U.S., for instance, has more than 40,000 cooperatives that are creating jobs for that economy. But someone will tell you that cooperatives are communist lingo and it doesn't work, but the U.S. is using it. Germany is using the same thing, and many other countries, and so on. So, how does our industrial policy facilitate a kind of interplay between these two, the big and the small sectors, and the upstream and the downstream industries? Is that something that we must focus on? In an attempt to nudge a lot more economic activity among these sectors. Lastly, Chairperson, I think that we must accept, and I'm talking to this issue of the skilled, the unskilled. I think that we must accept that global economy, including ourselves, has moved. Moved to high-skilled jobs. And we must use our education system to respond to that. And therefore, the private sector must come out and say, these are the kinds of jobs that are the kind of skills that are necessary to grow the economy and create the necessary employment. And this so that our institutions of learning must respond accordingly. This issue of institutions of learning being funded by government and then produce whatever they like, it can no longer be accepted. If you look at Careers 24, for instance, very few jobs advertised at any given moment between 20 and 30,000, and that's very little compared to unemployment. You will notice that all of them, literally all of them, are skilled jobs. I always want to use this example, Honorable Chairperson. I think around December 2013, there were 350 expatriates who came back into the country. It was in December of that year. By the end of January of the following year, 2014, all of them were employed, which tells you that those people came back with skills, experience, highly educated, and they found jobs readily available in the country. What does that tell you? We must move away, we must accept that the economy anywhere in the world today requires skills. Simple as all that. Otherwise, if we keep on excusing ourselves, finding all sorts of excuses why we are not focusing on this area, we will keep on saying our young people are unemployed and then start looking for unskilled jobs which don't exist anymore. Simple as all that. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much. Let me thank the still want to come. Oh, okay. All right. Honorable Member Chopestole.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you to the PBO for this good presentation. If you had brought it last year, I think I would have got a distinction in my studies. Now I am so sad that you brought it late. But it's very good. What I want to ask from you is to go and make a thorough research on the effect of our university curriculum on the economy. My colleague has said that, so I don't need to elaborate. We need to have a document, data to support our reason for reducing the funding for universities that don't come onto the show. Because we are serious here. We are an appropriation. We are a standing committee on appropriation. We are allocating funds to sectors of the state, and we believe that the funds that we allocate should really benefit the country. And we cannot stand by and just under our watch people creating their own little toy courses in universities using state money. And the economy is suffering. So we need a document per university to show how much do they produce that is relevant to supporting the economy of this country. And you see, I was just listening very carefully to Honorable Tabaza when he says expatriates went away. They came in December, by January they were employed. It means in other countries universities are serious. Here there is an attitude, according to me, that's what I feel now, of universities not being patriotic to the development of their own country. And it's very sad. That is one. Honorable Dr. Fick said something about the downturn, whether our economy is always going down. Yeah, I think presently we do have some, that's what I think. We do have that scenario. But I want us to remember that the recession started in 2008 and our economy resisted because of the conditions under which we were at that period of time. We had the world soccer. We also had our good policies, fiscal policies. And we must not forget to actually talk good about ourselves where we are doing the well. It is a fact that is known internationally that our systems are very transparent, and recently our tax collection are very good. Those things that we must always have in mind when we deal with things that are unfortunate. But there is a professor called Professor Joseph Sick. He's a Nobel Peace. Yes, he is the most cited economist of our time. And, you know, he explains that while technology, because of technology, we share jobs, not only here, but he was actually talking about the U.S. So we are not any different from the U.S. We are in the, because of the thing called, the monster called the globalization, in which we find ourselves. We suffer when the world suffers. You know, as a student, when you look at somebody's presentation, I quickly go to references. So I looked at your references, and I also saw IMF and World Bank. Then I quickly thought of my dear professor, Jung Chang, of the Cambridge University, on his two books, Kicking Away the Ladder and The Best American. I'm asking you to go and read those books. And I would like you to include those two professors of mine when you in your references. And you know, Professor Joseph Stiglitz, he wrote an article which it is called Joseph Stiglitz Heals the BRICS Bank. And I don't know why you don't talk about the BRICS, because that is a milestone in the history of our economic development. Maybe you hate it. I don't know why you hate it. I'm trying to encourage you to love it. Because, you see, as a small country like South Africa, for our president to have actually got us A, that is something in my heart that I will always remember, the history of this president, to get us to BRICS. Professor Joseph Stiglitz actually says, this BRICS is a step in the right direction. It brings competition to the world. It is moving from the old order, the Western thinking only, to what the world is today. So I'm trying to say, when you write your references, as a student of industrial policy, I would like you to include these two important guys. Professor Ajin Chang also wrote a book, Taking Development, Taking Manufacturing seriously. And I would like you to read those things and see if your attitude to us can not be nicer, at least to me. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your interventions, which took the form of clarity-seeking questions, comments, and let's agree. Some of the issues raised by the honorable members belong to the departments. And I'm sure when the departments come here, we will still raise those issues so that they can respond to some of the issues that we raised. And the DPI should be able to respond to some of the issues that we raised.
Mine was not for the department. I'm just asking them to refresh so that they can help us, because it will definitely improve this document.
Okay, thank you very much for that input. I will now allow the Parliamentary Budget Office to give those clarities, respond to the clarity seeking questions, but also if there are issues that you really want to elaborate on, this is your time. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honorable members. I just want to come in quickly. It's very interesting discussion, very insightful. I feel like I'm missing out, so I'm just to jump to the action there. just quick, I just want to come give clarity on some of the issues. I think my colleagues will address them as I'm going to have to pop up now. On the role of the TDO, I hear obviously to talk about international policy, and it's inevitable to talk to policy, product policy, and so on, economic policy and so on. I think the money bill does not allow us to pronounce government policy, whether it's good or wrong, or whatever. We're quite limited in that regard. We're not necessarily able to say whether this economic policy is working or not working. All we do is just provide analysis based on the money bill implications and on specific things related to money bill. So it's obviously a policy issue, but it's more we try to be linked to money bills related matters as we describe the costs of the incentives and so on. The other point, we will not necessarily want to announce in a committee chair what the committee should do, what the chairman should do in terms of the oversight. We can only give the analysis and what we found. It's the committee that decides what they do with the findings that we have. One quick point as well I picked up there is the capital versus intensity of the sectors. I think there was a report from the World Bank on behalf of the Tax Commission in 2014 or 2015, I don't remember, which does support the issue of the capital intensiveness of the incentives. There's a lot of uptake by the sector on the capital intensive. So it is the sector, many of the sectors are more capital intensive versus the labor intensiveness. There is quite evidence that supports that. And I hear, Chair, there's a lot of further work that's been recommended to the office, which is a good thing for us. But I would like to also suggest, ask the committee to also try to get more resources for the committee, for the office, because we're quite a small team. When she arrives to get more resources for the PLO, please do to support us where much possible, because I think we'll all agree that PLO is quite a small team, and we have four committees, and at times we have limited resources. Thank you very much, Chair. Nelia, thanks.
Thank you, Doctor. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Demisari. I'm just going to answer Honourable Lau. We're not allowed to make recommendations. We can show you all the points and the analysis, but we're not allowed to make recommendations in terms of the legislation. And then I'm going to give over to the team, and Richard will start with some of the questions on the specific slides, and then Brandon, and I think then Siraj can continue with the holistic picture of all the economic questions. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to stick strictly to the questions that are relevant to our report. Anything beyond that, I'm not in a position to answer authoritatively. So the first question that I'm going to respond to was on the things about business cycles. What this shows you is South African business cycles upward phase and downward phase. So when the economy is growing, it's called an upward phase. The moment you have a turning point and you have contraction, then it's actually a downward phase. So it's upward and downward phase, and we're not an outlier compared to other countries. And that's, you can get that from the Reserve Bank's quarterly bulletin. First question. Second question, I think there was some confusion regarding the GDP multiplier versus So in the context of inflation. So I made reference to both the GDP multiplier as well as deflator. So GDP deflator. For GDP deflator matters, it gives us spending in 1996 in 2006 prices. So we use that, and that's basically taken into consideration inflation. There's another question regarding inflation. So obviously inflation is a big determinant of the change in prices, or inflation is a change in prices. And our inflation is a bit higher than developing countries. It results in a larger deflator. Thank you. Customs duty, again, there are limitations on that. We only looked at customs duties. We could also look at the specific firms on CIT, corporate income tax. My colleagues covered it, we don't make proposals. We're looking at this as a year-on-year budgeting exercise. We have a longer-term perspective, and in the context of there being pretty slow growth in budgets, that makes this a pretty important discussion. Regarding incomplete data, we do know that this is an estimate of the cost of the law. Data is incomplete not because of a lack of transparency. Data is complete for multiple reasons, and one of them is now we have more, Treasury has made improvements over the years in terms of the data they capture, and so we have more recent years, richer data, and the further back you go, the less rich data you have. Next question was regarding the impact and risk of the economy. We have with the distributional impacts of incentives and industrial policy in general. Honourable McLaren, I guess my colleague Suraj may touch on why industrial policy is important and why we need it. We have discussed in limited extent in Chapter 2 of the long report some of the thinking around industrial policy. Tax expenditure, that term is used in the literature, it's used by traders around the world. Yes, it is difficult to get your head around it, sort of an expense coming out of the fiscus, but effectively it's money you could have had, but now it's not with you because you're dedicating it. We didn't look at corporate income tax, that's another question. Manufacturing employment as a percentage of GDP, manufacturing employment versus overall employment economy. In the past couple of years, the manufacturing sector's employment has grown slower than the rest of the economy, so you've seen stronger employment growth in other sectors. Honorable Lowe's questions is the first time we present the report, that's yes. You're asking questions of recent investments, which is of Honorable Obaza, regarding recent investments, whether they're showing in our data. Our data is up to 2014, so anything that took place in the last 2 years is not reflected because of the data lag. So what we have is the quarterly labor force survey as well as the quarterly employment statistics produced by StatsSA. They do that every quarter, as the name suggests, and so something that was captured in June this year will come out in August, September this year. Right? So StatsSA is quite on the ball. StatsSA have their categories of employment. An organizational context, we can take StatsSA numbers and then try and break it down by different sectors. So StatsSA won't give you employment for clothing and textiles. They won't give you employment for the auto sector. They'll give you lumped up manufacturing. And then you break it. And so context, break it down. So it's not because there's a data lag in that respect. Again, my colleague covered that decision making is not the role of the PBOs, it's Parliament. Unintended consequences, by which we mean unintended distortions. For example, a subsidized firm, the firm receiving the subsidy from the state, in the sector may outcompete non-subsidized. So you have 10 firms in the public sector, 10 are receiving subsidies, they're more competitive, can invest in more machinery, or have some incentives that reduce their labor costs. They can actually maybe engage in more competitive pricing, and after a long time they could build out and then push out smaller firms that are not receiving the incentive. So there are these, this is a very simple example of unintended consequences. I think that was all that related to me, and I think my colleagues will explain the balance.
Let me see if I can remember.
there's a question around whether policies are designed to participate in the global economy. Do we promote exports? I can speak to the auto policies and the policies in the clothing and textiles industry. And you know, as I mentioned in the presentation, that in '94 there was a bit of a problem with anti-export bias, and it seems as if they just, if you look at the numbers, had some success in promoting exports. So I think a lot of the policies were intentioned, and they have had an increase in exports as an explicit objective. Determining the degree of that success, as we said, is a bit difficult, but I think are we trying to promote exports? Certainly in those sectors, yes. From my reading of those particular sectors. I think you've covered the dip. Do we do for the rest of the world? Yes. So was there a substantial increase in the subsidies used in the clothing textile sector? It's a little tricky to say, because the BCCS, that lasted for about 10 years, and the uptake was pretty substantial. That then morphed into this TCIDP, which seemed to incorporate a similar DCCS scheme within it, but just expanded somewhat. But that ran for about 4 years, so kind of the time spans were all different. So it's hard to say. We can look at aggregated numbers. And then I know the CCIDP uptake is still quite small at the moment, but again, they've expanded it even further. So it actually incorporates some of the previous incentives. So I could get more specific numbers on that, but as I say, because they all ran for different periods, if you look at the aggregated numbers, it might not be that informative. No, we haven't done any work on looking at illicit trades at all, and how it impacts the industry's growth. That's potentially something we could look at in the future, but certainly not in this project, so we can look at that. We didn't acquire any employment numbers from the other industries who may have benefited from outsourcing. You were talking about that potential, so there's a loss in employment in a specific industry, but it might be because they're outsourcing, so the net might be positive. We don't have those numbers, but that would be very interesting to look at. So also not factoring in other taxes stemming from the support, so that's something I did consider. Obviously, just looking at customs duties is pretty narrow, so there's a whole range of, and if we did a more kind of general, which would a general analysis, I don't know how we do this, but CGEs or something like that, to look at the impact of incentive on the industry as a whole, and looking at all the different taxes and all the different benefits, it would be it would be very interesting. Why the clothing and textiles industry continues to grow after 2008? As I said earlier, my interpretation of that was the exports seemed to fall pretty strongly until just after 2008. 2009-10 they seemed to kind of plateau, but my interpretation of that at least would be that there's some kind of substitution for domestic production. So the fact that they were able to grow despite the financial crisis might just indicate that they were substituting exports for domestic sales. That's my, just from the data, maybe there's a more complex reason. I'm sure there are reasons. The 1.6 times, I think that refers to the manufacturing sector as a whole. And then when I say 2.5 times, that's specifically for the motor vehicle components. So it's, and then one thing on the way the incentive works. It's not necessarily money for free for private sector companies. The way they work is that a lot of them require some kind of action by the private sector. So, for example, if they want to invest in expanding the capacity of a production plant, they will then have to meet a whole bunch of certain criteria, and they'll have to apply for a grant, for example, and then they'll get a percentage of the money that they've invested. But the point is, they need to make investment first. So it's a partnership more than anything. It's not just a grant for doing nothing. So in that sense, there's some kind of a partnership going on there. And it's the same for any kind of tax rebate for customs. If you plan to import raw materials to export, the company would need to take the action of actually importing raw material, then you get your tax rebate. So in that sense, you might say the incentives to actively promote investment by the private sector through that partnership. And I think that's everything I've got.
Thank you. Just to come back to the question of data, I think one of the difficulties mentioned was the access to data, and one of the other members raised the point that, you know, there are chambers of commerce and industry places where we can source data. I think for this kind of study, I think we actually don't have the staff and the capacity to do that kind of in-depth studies with field work and stuff. And a lot of these kinds of studies end up being mostly what we call desktop studies and using existing data sources. Now, one of the big problems is, and I think it's not only us, but people in government departments and others face this problem, is that South Africa stopped collecting per-level data back in the towards the end of the 1980s. And so one really good source of understanding what was happening at the firm level in South Africa hasn't been updated for a really long time. So we're working with the existing data sources, but there is a big gap to our understanding, but that's across departments. And as Rashad was saying, National Treasury is looking at seeing whether that gap can be filled, and I think the Department of Trade and Industry is also very interested in that. I know previously an academic, we have spoken to South Africa and also asked him, you know, why don't you guys restart collecting this, but I think it's also about their priority. I do want to there are lots of questions about labor and labor intensity and employment decreasing and, you know, whether the investments are happening and should be supported because they're not employment creating. And one of the things I wanted to say in my introduction in the beginning was that, you know, when you think about manufacturing and the role it plays in the economy as an engine of growth, something that has very strong linkages to other sectors, and therefore when your manufacturing sector grows, it has a positive impact on the overall growth of the economy and sort of enriches the contribution of other parts of the economy. It's also one of the sectors where you actually find a much more intensive use of knowledge and a move towards value added. And so I know we're not supposed to talk about the successes of policies and sort of directly promote and suggest things, but I think what we've seen happening in industrial policy in South Africa has been an adaptation towards trying to move towards increased use of knowledge, technology, in an environment globally and in South Africa where they've been really a lot of push for increased use of capital and increased use of labor. And I also mentioned the fact that there's been a lot of outsourcing. And so, you know, we just show numbers for manufacturing employment. What the numbers that we don't show is the increase in services jobs. And I spoke about the increase in business services jobs, where you find private security and outsourced jobs and also labor banking jobs included. What our numbers are formal sector employment. It doesn't include informal sector employment. In some cases, people have been outsourced into firms providing, say, cleaning services or for labor broking purposes, would now fall into the informal sector. And so they would also fall outside of the numbers we're putting in. So there are a lot of those kind of problems. But I think, in our contribution as a parliamentary budget office to your work as people who decide how the money gets spent and where you think the money is best spent, the advice we can give you is that, you know, we do want to see more jobs in manufacturing. We do want to see the possibility of creating more, supporting more labor-intensive sectors. But overall, the impact that manufacturing has on jobs, and I think our honourable members spoke about Arjun Chang and Joseph Stiglitz. We find that in their work, especially Arjun Chang's work of looking at the experience in East Asia and South Korea from the 1960s is that the growth of manufacturing allows other sectors to create jobs. and increase the ability of the economy to create jobs. And often those jobs aren't necessarily created directly in manufacturing. And so the job that manufacturing plays as an engine of growth isn't one of increasing jobs. You're always going to get much more jobs in services. But what manufacturing does is it changes by having a viable, dynamic, growing, competitive manufacturing sector that actually allows a much, much deeper and wider, broader development of the services sector to not only be, say, wholesale retail services or private security services, but a much larger range of productive services, and with that, a much bigger growth of the small business sector and the cooperative business sector. So we can't look directly to incentives to support manufacturing to look at jobs in small business and cooperatives. I think what we can do is, so when we think about the goals of spending, I think the goal is to say, should be, you know, is manufacturing playing that role of value adding and deepening the industrial base of the economy, which is the state objective in the National Industrial Policy Framework and the ITAF. Just one thing about Arjun Chang and John Stiglitz, I think, you know, we personally, I mean, I draw a huge amount on their work, and I've actually worked with Arjun Chang in setting up the African Program on Rethinking Development Economics, which still runs, and he still comes to South Africa regularly to teach in that program. And so a lot of, I think, what we're seeing in the industrial policy side and the way we actually think about how do we give you advice on how money should be spent to see whether government or the government departments providing the incentives are doing that in an effective way is influenced by that broader understanding of industrial policy and what it does and what it can do. Which is also why in the beginning I spoke about, you know, when you're translating a financial measure, which is what we're doing, saying these are the costs of program, but you have to actually measure output, the success and effectiveness in terms of economic issues. You have to translate what finance does into economic outcomes. You should have very strong short-term measures to say, are you doing this? Did you spend the money? You know, has the money been taken up? Has it been used? But then you should also look to the long-term in terms of, has there been increased value add? Has there been increased exports? Are the skills developing in those sectors? And you know, what are the employment implications? And what I was implying earlier was that possibly as we move into doing more and more of this work, and I think as you as honourable members start interacting more with the relevant departments in GPI or small business or other sectors, I think you can also sharpen the questions that you want us to investigate to support you. and so we can have that two-way process of refining this process over time. Because I think it's going to be really important for us to keep supporting, you know, industrial incentives. But I think the way we do it can be adapted, and the questions were relevant, you know, is are we doing the right kind of industrial policy? Why is the industrial policy changing over time? That has been important, and I think the broader picture that you're giving, I think maybe contrary to some of the responses we've seen, isn't that industrial policy is wrong or unsuccessful, it may not be meeting the direct implementation challenge, but we have seen increased value added and increased exports and increased incentives over time. What we aren't saying, and what's really difficult for us to say, and I think I said that several times, and Richard, I think in the beginning, also said that, it is really difficult with the longer term, bigger goals of industrial policy to match spending to achievement. And for us to say, you know, even if we hadn't spent that money, this would have happened. The other point I made was that in terms of when we're in the upturn in the business cycle, when the global economy is in a good space, then the role of incentives is different to when there's a crisis and a downturn. So that was the other point I wanted to make as well. I think they were really good questions, and we're probably missing quite a few, but I thought I'd try and cover most of them, especially the ones into employment, small business, and cooperatives within that. There were questions about almost destructive outcomes into the past, you know, and you know, are we supporting you know, established white businesses and become more successful through industrial policies. I think the bigger question for the economy is, you know, we may be supporting businesses that have been around for a long time, and we have seen DE and shifting, but largely those businesses, many of those businesses are still in white hands, like Toyota. You know, the Wessel family bought it from the Japanese mother company in the 60s when they moved out of the country. But the impact of Toyota on the Eastern Cape economy and the national economy and the ability to create and wealth for more redistributive purposes, I think, has been huge out of that. And so that, so those kind of issues we really need to think about. And I think maybe as the elected officials, you need to guide us on how we need to think about that and the information we can provide you to look at redistributive issues in industrial incentives and other support mechanisms. Because that I think, as a political dimension, that's probably much more experienced and suited to do than we are. But we do recognize that in industrial incentives, that isn't usual, right? And that we do need to provide you with that information. But you need to tell us how you're thinking about it and then what will suit you. And also maybe pull DPI and other departments into that discussion as well more to tease that out. So these are really complex issues, and we do want to support you and understand how to support you in doing that. And there are a huge amount of challenges, both at the qualitative level, at the quantitative level, but then also just in understanding the political outcomes and those kind of issues as well. So I'm going to stop there again. I think maybe if there are questions we did miss, maybe the honourable members will come back and say you didn't answer my question on this specific issue.
Honourable members, are there follow-up questions, not new questions, follow-up questions, so that we can, our agenda is still long, and I know we've given this sufficient time. That's why I really would invite for follow-up questions. Right, Honourable Member Shoppe Stole, Honourable Member Dokafik.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to know if they are scared to talk about BRICS or something like that.
Just a question on the clarity regarding the tax expenditure thing. Is it recorded as either income or expenditure? If so, or reported, how is it reported or recorded? I'm talking about the financial statements. And or is it budgeted for? Because if it's not recorded, then and it's budgeted for, then we might end up with a bigger deficit than we actually have. So can I just get an indication of how that is reported, please? Thank you.
Okay, on the BRICS question, we actually, within the terms of reference for the specific study, we didn't see the BRICS relationship and setting up the BRICS as directly relevant. I think, I'm not saying that it isn't relevant, and I think I agree with the honorable member that the BRICS it could turn out to be really important within the shifting space in the global economy and in terms of our development and having a sort of south-driven economic development. So, possibly in the future, you know, as we getting, there may be specific programs within the BRICS or cooperations amongst BRIC countries, but also within the BRICS Development Bank that do support industrial incentives and things, and then we will definitely consider those. So we're not afraid of it and we're not sort of avoiding it. I think within the current brief it was, we didn't feel necessarily directly relevant. In the expenditure side and tax side, I mean what we're talking about is foregone earnings, and so it's not budgeted. But I mean, I think, you know, when these programs are implemented, it has to be taken into account in doing budget projections. So it doesn't come as a direct cost to the country, but it does come into account in saying, you know, because we now have this program, and this program, say, if you look at what's in the auto sector until 2020, we have to actually, in our budget forecast, subtract so much per year in terms of estimated support for that program. So that's how it works. Well, I mean, what, again, I mean, I keep sort of coming back to this, talking about the one on the finance side and sort of the accounting side, on the other side is the economic analysis side. And a lot of what we in terms of assessing effectiveness of programs, we look at it from an economic perspective, and then you treat foreign revenue the same way as you treat direct spending. I mean, from an accounting side, and in terms of sustainability of the budget deficit, Koban revenue is important, but you know the money that you take directly out of your pocket is foremost on your mind, and so there is a different way of thinking about it. But I think you know maybe over time, maybe a period of 10 years, it's almost like with this report, we're trying to fill a backlog. We went from 94 to 2014-15. Maybe if we do this kind of report in 2 years or 3 years for the committee. You know, we could start focusing on the year-to-year thing, or maybe looking at over a medium-term budget framework, say for 3 years, and then we can actually talk about out-of-pocket expenditure much more directly and thinking about benefit and costs associated with those in those terms. But I think we are at the beginning of a process, which hopefully you find to be a useful beginning of this process. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for a fruitful engagement. It does look like we've come, we've exhausted the discussion. Am I reading the situation correctly? Agreed. Well, honourable member, ladies and gentlemen, let me take this opportunity and thank the support staff for finding a suitable venue for us and making sure that this meeting sits today. Thank you very much. Just keep up the good work. I would also like to thank the PBO for the well-researched presentation on the costs and outcomes of the Industrial Development Initiative for the accounting period 1994 to 2014-15. Well, thank you very much. And also, I really must thank you for the adequate responses. I'm sure you've also experienced this. I've got a very good team. Now, I look at them. Indeed, they have nothing to ask now because you provided adequate responses. All right, honourable members, we have received the briefing and deliberated with the PDO on the cost and outcome of industrial development initiatives in South Africa for the period, for the accounting period 1994-95 to 2014-15. Indeed, as the committee, we appreciate and welcome the report by the PBO. This briefing will greatly assist the committee in its oversight role so as to assist the growth of the economy, given the fact that industrial policy initiatives have increased substantially over the last 3 years. Well, as a committee, or on behalf of the committee, we need to ensure effectiveness and efficiency, firstly, of the allocation, and also, secondly, of these initiatives, as significant amounts of funding is appropriated as a share of national budget, industrial development initiatives. From the briefing, we have found that over 290 billion in nominal rent and have been allocated over the 20 years between the 1994-05 and 2014-15 financial years. This is the amount that has been allocated. It's a lot of money. Well, the outcomes of these initiatives, therefore, need to be achieved as the successful implementation of same will assist with job creation and ultimately with accelerated economic growth in South Africa. However, of concern is the report by the PBO that many programs do not have clear and explicit targets. So in our oversight function, we have to make sure that you know, this area, there's an improvement in this area in particular. There must be clear and explicit targets, which will impact, now, the absence of these clear and explicit targets will definitely impact negatively on the monitoring and evaluation of outcomes and benefits by both the national legislature as well as other key stakeholders such as the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. Major challenges have also been reported by PBO in the clothing and textile industry initiatives, which show that there has been a decline in the industry, notwithstanding the introduction of these development initiatives by government. To this end, we therefore need to strengthen our oversight over the implementing departments of these industrial development initiatives. We note the undertaking by the PDO that it will develop more in a focused way of presenting these reports in future, focus on outcomes and the economic benefits derived from the appropriated funds, along with the associated challenges experienced. As agreed, the committee will formally request the PDO to conduct more research on manufacturing exports versus imports, as well as an analysis of the skills produced by higher learning institutions as well as the skills required by the economy. Have I captured you correctly? PBO? Yes, okay. I thank the committee members and the Parliamentary Budget Office for the fruitful engagements during today's meeting. To be accurate, I know that the committee requested for this research, and today I can confidently say that the mission has been accomplished. Thank you very much. And the meeting between ourselves and PBO is adjourned. And the committee, we still have just two few activities, the minutes, and then we're done with our meeting. Thank you very much. Now, on your way out, I know that there's tea served there, there's juice. Please do take or do participate, otherwise there'll be a fruitless expenditure or wasteful expenditure. Thank you very much. Okay. See you again soon. Next week. Yeah. Okay, thanks. All right, honourable members, as they quietly move out, can we then quickly look at the minutes? There is one copy of the minutes. Minutes of the 23rd of August 2016. The minutes were circulated on time, and the assumption is that the members have read the minutes. Shall we then look at the correctness of the minutes? Starting from page 1. Page 2. Any questions? Page 3. Can you share the discussion there? Did I just hear you saying I haven't read the minutes? No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I'm pleading for your name. Okay, no, that's fine. We are on page 3. We're looking at corrections on page 3. Remember, Thomas?
Very small grammatical correction on 4.2, the second last line.
4.2, second last line?
With the sentence written, the committee was of the view that the National Treasury should not place savings ahead of compliance with regulations instead of all regulations.
To which National Treasury? Okay, compliance with the regulations. Yeah, okay, fine. The committee are we in agreement with that correction? It says the committee was of the view that National Treasury should not place savings. It should be above compliance. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Above compliance. Because compliance must be above. You must always comply. Regardless.
Mm-hmm.
Compliance, yeah. Or the regulations, yes. Thank you very much for that correction, Mr. Tuavaza. Any other corrections? None. Shall we then move to page 4?
Jay. May I please get a proposal for adoption? Honourable Member McLaughlin is proposing. Any seconder? Honourable Member Lowe is seconding. What that means is that this is a true reflection of what transpired in the previous meeting. May I request the Secretary to bring all the minutes for my signature? That will complete the cycle. All right, thank you very much. And then we have also circulated a draft, third draft, of a third program of the Steering Committee on Appropriations. Have you all seen the draft?
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the draft, right? I know that we have requested the researchers to also assist us, remember, with prioritization of the state-owned enterprise, which we will entertain in the next term. This one is in the fourth term, this is the third term, the fourth term. So this is the third term, and on this third term, we will be focusing on these areas. And we are also happy because we are part and parcel of the selection, actually. All right, okay. Shall we then make a proposal for adoption of the program of action?
I have a question. It seems the water sanitation on Fridays. Any particular reason for that?
For Fridays? No, I don't know. Ministers must tell me. You are better experienced here than me.
They say it's because there is a lot of water on Fridays.
Also, they want to save the water. Okay. Yes, all I remember, no?
Can I just propose, Jay, can't we swap the communication and water sanitation rather with those two days?
Because really they like the Fridays, and then when they get here, they are in a rush to leave. So can I please propose that we swap those two, because I don't think telecommunication has such burning issues than water sanitation.
Okay. There's a proposal on the table? Agreed. Agreed too. Thank you very much. So that is the only correction. Yeah? But do you agree that we adopt this with the amendments?
Yeah.
Agreed. Thank you very much. We've made good progress. Thank you so much. And I was also impressed with your engagement. You know, economics is very tricky. The language, then I heard, we nearly got stuck on the nominal rent. And I said to myself, me, I'm not caring anymore. But at the end, we did get clarity. Yeah, it is an economic jargon. Yeah. No, it was very interesting. But we're growing also, man.
You know the person
yes.
Thing.
Yes, ma'am.
Professor Ideal Tam is agreeing that he says economy should be made simple so that everybody can get to it.
Yeah.
It is made difficult with by using jargon and mathematics.
But you know what we can't avoid, ne, is that every sector has its own language. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. The meeting stands adjourned. And it's I. I didn't agree with that.